Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I am Carlos Collazo, joined by Jacob Rudner. This is our penultimate preseason draft podcast. How are you doing, Jacob?
I'm doing well. We're here. This is it. It's college baseball season, basically. And you and I are going to hit the ground running, so I'm excited.
Yeah, I guess the next podcast you hear from us on the draft and college side will technically record before the season starts, but at least for the draft podcast, when you're hearing it, next week we'll actually be out at fields watching games. So
yep.
I cannot wait. And so on today's episode, we want to break down and analyze and just get into the weeds on our recently updated draft board. Every year we roll out an update just ahead of the college season getting started. We typically expand that list to the top 200 players. That is the case with this update, and there's a lot of movement. And maybe it's worth just going over part of the process here, Jacob, because I did get some comments and questions in our draft chat this week kind of asking, hey, like on this update, there are players with significant up-down moves, but nothing has really happened since your last update. So how exactly does that work? And I think it is useful in just pointing out, like, for this draft board and this draft list, we're constantly trying to get new information on players, and we're constantly diving in into the profiles of these players. And I will say that while there are no games that have happened in between this update and our previous one, we've still gotten a lot of new information on players from the fall. There have been a lot of fall workouts. Jacob's had a lot of conversations with coaches about like what players are doing differently. Scouts have been evaluating players. And it's also the case that sometimes we're just hearing more information that we didn't have previously. So I think for the draft board, I like to view it as this constant iterative list that we're constantly trying to improve and tweak. And maybe if a player is similar from our last update to our current update, but we have vastly more information about that player that we didn't have last time, we still want to implement it. So hopefully that explains like kind of a little bit about the behind the scenes process. But what are your thoughts on this update as we head into the year, Jacob?
Yeah, I mean, I've always viewed this as kind of the most critical. You can make an argument for it that it's the most critical update that we do, because I think that it sets the stage for who you need to be watching during the college and the high school seasons. Like, this is the list now as we see it, based on the feedback, like you said, that we have and the information that we've been able to study independently, which I think is a really important part of our process as well. Just like the amount of hours that go into sitting down and really working to understand each player on our own before we go and get feedback. And then we ask questions based on what we think we understand, and then we adjust from there. And this, to me, is the first list that is really comprehensive in that we know who we're watching now. Like, you have all of the fall changes and improvements and rumors and whatever injuries matter and start to kind of come out at this time of year. And this list sets it all up. I mean, now you have, and we're going to talk about this and I'll spoil it, but like Cameron Flueke goes into the year as the number one starting pitcher in the country. And that was Liam Pederson for the entire offseason. Well, I think that that is really valuable because it sets the stage for what we're going to see over the course of the next couple months in the college season. And it goes to show you what certain players have to do, to either regain a certain status or to hold on to something. And so if I were to, you know, urge our readers to really pay attention to and take some time to study a list or a story that we do, it would be the preseason top 200 draft rankings. Because again, I really think that it's kind of the tone setter for everything that you're going to see at the player level for the next few months.
Yeah, it kind of serves as the canon list for us entering the year. I know Matt Eddy uses that phrase when talking about our top 100 lists. Like, yes, we've reached a point where there are lots of updates that happen midseason. But if you're going to go back and look at a draft class historically, it's this preseason list that currently went out, and it's the actual list on draft day that are really serving as kind of the benchmark for how we're viewing players entering the draft year and at the end of the stage. So in June and July, when we're talking about player X made certain jumps, player X regress, it'll be with this sort of ranking and positioning on the draft board serving as like the baseline context for that. So with kind of the nitty gritty out of the way, I wanted to move through this podcast in maybe three parts. First, I want to talk about some of the key movement inside the first round. It's obviously the most important element of this draft list. The guys at the top are crucial and kind of define the strength of a draft class. Then I wanted to maybe go further out and say, who are the biggest up arrow names overall on this draft list, expanding out beyond the first round? And then after, maybe some thoughts on notable players who are moving down this board, and maybe questions that they'll have an opportunity to answer this spring to maybe counteract some of that movement. But first round, it's the most fun talk. You already mentioned Cameron Flukie in the SP1 spot. But for me, I have like five players that I think are worth discussing here in this update that have notable up arrow movement within the first round. That's Cameron Flukie and Jackson Flora, who you mentioned. Not sure if you alluded to Flora, but we've got Flukie and Flora inside the top five, 1-2 in our starting pitching rankings or just pitcher rankings overall. Drew Burris gets into the top 10 at number 9 overall. He's now the top outfielder in the class. And then two players further down the board who jump into the first round who were not in the first round previously, Eric Booth Jr., the high school outfielder out of Mississippi. He's like slap dab in the middle of the first round. And then Ryder Helfrich at Arkansas, who we've talked about quite a bit just in terms of the up arrow feedback. It feels nice to have him in a position that actually feels like realistic based on that feedback. So that was one we were trying to get for a while now. So I'll throw it to you, Jacob. Are there any of those guys you want to dig into first?
Yeah, I mean, I've been super fascinated by the conversation about the top three pitchers so far, and so I'll start there. I think that for us right now, it's become clear that even if this isn't the most outstanding college pitching class overall, and the feedback that we got, you know, heading into the year was that this might be a little bit of a lighter group in its totality on the college pitching side. The top end of that group is outstanding. It is not every year that we have three college arms inside our top 10. We will have that this year going into the season. Cameron Flukie, Jackson Flora, Liam Peterson. Peterson moved back a little bit, five spots. He was fourth previously, was our SP1. We'll actually have him starting the year as SP3, which I thought was interesting. I know we're talking about up arrows, but I found that to be kind of notable just because it goes to show you that the conversation does evolve. And I think there's kind of an element of like Liam Peterson has to go out there and show it now, whereas the other two, being Flora and Flukie, don't have to do that. There's a lot less to kind of figure out with the two of them. Obviously, they need to go perform. That this isn't to say that they don't need to go be good, but I think there's less mystery when it comes to Flukie and Flora. Flukie's impressive, man. Like, you watch him and he looks funky because he's just so lean and like long-limbed, and it's just the delivery is kind of this like unique, kind of messy almost. It's like very loud, noisy.
Every time I watch him pitch, I think of those tall inflatable inflatable men at the car washes that you see. And Coastal has a couple of those arms on the team. They've got the market for gangly armed pitchers locked down.
Yeah, but the way that the ball comes out is special. I mean, it's really, really good stuff. And he throws strikes too. You and I talked about that on a previous draft podcast. It's like an unbelievably impressive strike rate for somebody who is so mechanically funky and just has the stuff that he has. Like, he's really all over the zone. Last year with his fastball that averaged 20.3 inches of IVB was a 73.7% strike rate. He gets whiffs and chases on it. He gets great extension too. Like, I think that that's kind of another thing that doesn't necessarily get talked about a lot with Flukie, is that in addition to just the raw fastball traits, super flat approach, he gets down the mound exceptionally well within this really weird delivery, and he is kind of the most complete pitcher, I would say, of this group. And while there was conversation to be had between him and Flora for who belongs as SP1, none of these three guys throw strikes like Flukie does. So the combination of stuff and strike throwing, I think, put him at the first spot.
This is kind of how I'm thinking of this trio of arms, and tell me if you disagree or what your thoughts are. But to me, Cameron Flukie right now feels like the safest, most polished, ready-made starter, the guy you can feel most confident in, that his arsenal as currently constructed, what he's previously done with Coastal, there are just few question marks that I have with him. I think for Jackson Flora, I maybe am most excited about his pure arm talent compared to either of these other two pitchers. But with Flora and Liam Peterson, I feel like there may be more opportunities for them to dramatically redefine like who they are as pitchers. And for Flora in particular, his arsenal, like what that's going to look like and how effective it is. I think there are a lot of reasons for us to be really excited about the changeup he's been working on, another breaking ball he's been working on. But a year ago, his pitch usage was basically just fastball slider. We have not really seen him get further into his bag in terms of a third pitch. I think, again, I'm very optimistic about what the changeup is going to look like. But a year ago, his non-fastball slider usage was essentially 4% split between a changeup and a curveball. I would expect and hope that he is implementing more pitches into his mix this year. And so just how good those other pitches wind up being and how that maybe transforms his arsenal, I think, is going to be really fascinating. And because of that uncertainty, but also just the flashes we've seen in the fall, like if Flora comes out and the changeup is great, and he's also got a curveball that looks like another weapon to add to the fastball slider, I think he could easily wind up being the SP1 with a strong season. And in the same way that Liam Peterson, I feel like, has some clear areas to address, and I could see him tackling those as well. You've written a lot about some of the mechanical tweaks he's made, the fact that his curveball is sneakily like one of the better pitches in college baseball, but that's another pitch that he really just didn't use that much. If he becomes even more of this north-south extreme profile, if he adds another wrinkle to his fastball by working in the two-seam in addition to the four-seam, and on top of all that, I think he's maybe the one pitcher of this group that needs to make the most strides in the command department.
Big time.
But that's kind of where my mentality is at for all these pitchers. And I feel like while Flukie is SP1 in some ways, from like a what we're excited to see and watch this spring, Flora and Peterson are maybe the more interesting arms.
I think that's fair. I think with Flora specifically, because of the amount of changes he's made to the arsenal and even some pitches that were already existent in the arsenal. So like his fastball apparently is playing differently than it did last year. And it was a really good pitch. It was 18 yeah. inches IVB, super flat approach, -4.61.
He had a 27%, 27% miss rate with that pitch last spring. Sorry.
Yeah. 27% miss. The chase is also roughly 27%. And then extension wise, he gets down the mound exactly like Flukie does. They have almost an identical extension number. So the fastball was already good. What exactly it means that he's changed it now makes me I'm super intrigued to see exactly what that looks like. He actually wasn't great last year when it came to using his fastball against left-handed hitters. They just saw it better. And one of the things that they paid attention to, and when I say they, I mean UCSB, which is one of the premier college pitch developing programs in the country, like Andrew Checkitz, who asks coaches around the league, who's the guy who's going to turn somebody from, you know, zero to hero? It's Andrew Checkitz. Like he's an outstanding pitch developer. And so I do trust kind of where these changes are coming from and who is implementing them. I have said before on the college pod, I think I might've even said it before on the draft pod, my SP1, when I kind of rank these guys out going into the year, is already Jackson Flora. I have heard that the changeup that he has, I don't want to say added because he threw a changeup last year, but it's that new kick change, like very in kick change grip that everybody's throwing.
Everyone's adding a kick change this offseason. That's the in-vogue pitch.
It is. And I think one of the reasons for that is because from everything I understand, you can kind of get away with just throwing it hard. Like you don't have to do anything too extreme in terms of like hand position and the way that you rotate around the baseball. That's not as important with this type of changeup. And I think for Flora specifically, that plays really well just with his sheer arm strength and arm speed. And so that kind of fits seamlessly into the arsenal. You mentioned the curveball that he's been working on. I don't actually think we're going to see that as much as maybe it's been talked about this offseason. To me, that's more of a change of pace in between offering for the slider and the sweeper that he throws. The sweeper is like comfortably plus to me. So we're talking about an arm that has an arguably plus fastball that has a plus changeup, maybe from everything that I've heard from people. The sweeper comfortably plus. I think the slider is at least average. And then this curveball variant that he's added to the mix fits somewhere maybe in that like average, slightly below average range until further notice. And he's a pretty decent strike thrower too. Like, it's going to be hard to argue with him.
Yeah. Your point about left-handed hitters is interesting. And I think it gets to kind of my questions about what the pitch mix is going to look like. Right-handed hitters last spring managed just a 465 OPS against him. And his pitch usage was 50% fastball, 46% slider, and 3% curveball based on our synergy data that we have. So basically an even split of fastball slider. If you look at how he attacks left-handed hitters, the fastball rate jumps up to 64%, the slider rate drops to 27%, and you see a little bit more usage of the changeup, 6%. But I think it makes sense to me intuitively that left-handed hitters do better against the fastball just because it's easier for them to sit on that pitch, kind of eliminate the slider as something they need to think about to the same degree that right-handed hitters do. And so if you can just get another pitch that you feel comfortable throwing to lefties, I feel like you're going to unlock a whole new level with Flora. So that's definitely what I'm looking at with him.
And something that I think is interesting, just based on the feedback that I was able to gather from the fall and then, you know, very shortly so far in the lead up to the season, that changeup is something that he's already comfortable throwing to both sides of the plate, which is like, that's loud to me, is that you have a right-handed pitcher who didn't really use his changeup at an extreme rate at all last year, has gone from using it as kind of this change of pace against left-handed batters who he struggled with, to now throwing this to both sides of the plate, and I have multiple evaluators telling me that it's a plus pitch. Again, I think that Flora has a really strong case to be SP1 right now, and it wouldn't surprise me to see him really dominate in the conference that he's in, which will make it kind of like the Bremner situation, where you're going to be in a really good spot if you're a team picking 2, 3, 4, and you want a college arm that can move fast in your system. I think Flora is going to be able to fit that bill, but again, I also think that that's true with Peterson and Flukie. So like, the best thing about this top of draft class for the college pitching is that it is really close. Like, I don't think that you are wrong to have a preference for any of these three guys. Like, there's no clear winner to be at this stage.
Like, I think even among BA staffers, like, your preference would probably be Flora, mine would be Flukie right now, and I think Ben Badler has said he would take Peterson. So like, just among us three, we all have different opinions, and the fact that they are close makes it interesting to watch. But definitely a good set of arms at the top of the college class. All right, let's move into some of these hitters a little bit further down in the first round. Both Eric Booth Jr. And Ryder Helfrich, I think, two of the other notable guys to mention here in our first round conversation. You said you're more excited about Eric Booth at this point. It feels like increasingly everyone in the industry is. You break down the tools, the age, the athleticism, the feel for the barrel. Pretty much the only thing that is a little bit suspect with EJ Booth is the swing is just a little bit unorthodox. It looks unusual, but I've increasingly gotten more comfortable with hitters who just do it a bit oddly. If they're showing a good approach, if they're hitting the ball hard, if they're making contact, you kind of hit how you hit, and I'll leave the mechanical fine tuning to the experts in that department. But Eric Booth Jr., now our top high school outfielder, I think both him and Blake Bowen, right into the middle of the first round, you can make compelling cases for either of those. But what's your excitement level with Mr. Booth at this stage?
It's pretty high. And to give people a look behind the curtain a little bit, when we were having our conversation about how we were going to re-rack the top 200 and guys who needed to move up, I had Eric Booth higher than 15th, which is where he's going to enter the year. I think he's super exciting. Listen, he's got great speed. I think that the tools to be able to go and play a premium position while being an impact bat are there. I'm not so scared at all by the potential of needing to rework some things mechanically with a high school hitter. Like, to me, if you can bring premium tools to the table and you do a lot of things well with bad mechanics, I have a hard time ignoring that. And I don't know that there's, outside of Grady Emerson, who's like very clearly the best high school player in this class, I don't know that there are a lot of high school guys that have like such screaming tools to me. There are people who would argue that Tyler Spangler is in that category. Jacob Lombard, I know, has a lot of supporters. But like, for me, the speedy, athletic, good feel to hit, really good instincts center fielder is the most intriguing of that group. And so I personally think we could have been more aggressive than 15th. I like where we have him. It would not surprise me if he ends up in the top 10 on our rankings and in the top 10 on draft day, though, just because it's a really talented left-handed bat.
And I think, too, this is a profile that basically in the draft, very few teams are going to come away not liking. For all the reasons you mentioned, he has extreme youth on his side. So the model-heavy teams who are still factoring in age for hitters are really going to like him. There are a number of teams picking in the back of the top 10 who I would associate with really weighing that heavily in their draft models. And I hope, too, that with Booth this year, we can maybe start to move away from the skepticism about Mississippi high school hitters. Because at this point, I just think the way that hitters are developed and tested at the high school level with travel ball, with showcases, they're getting out of that area enough to get exposed to better pitching and better competition. And I just feel like the skepticism that was maybe warranted because Mississippi high school baseball is a little bit down relative to other states around them just doesn't really hold. We've had so many good examples of young hitters who've come out of the state in recent years, most notably Connor Griffin, the top prospect in baseball.
That's pretty good.
He's okay. So I just think hopefully we don't have to hear about that too much this year. And I even hesitated to even bring this up because I don't want to talk about it, but it would be nice if that goes away. And I think that we have enough tools to evaluate players outside of the context of like the high school they play in. So that's Booth. Let's get into Ryder Helfrich really quickly before we work a little bit further down the list. For you, Ryder Helfrich versus Von Lackey for catcher one. I feel like it's a similar conversation to the pitching trio we're talking about at the top of the college class. And it really wouldn't shock me at all if Helfrich just went off this year, showed a little bit more contact, and we're talking about him as a potential top 10 pick. He's not in that range now. We've got him in the back third. But teams love college catchers. So if teams are feeling like he's definitely going to stick behind the plate and he's gotten a lot better feedback as a defender this offseason than I expected him to get, the sort of impact that he brings to the table at that position, it might be hard to pass on if he has another really strong year.
I mean, you just hit on the most important piece of this conversation, and that is who is going to end up being perceived as the better defender, because that will ultimately determine, in my opinion, which of these two catchers who you mentioned, Von Lackey and Ryder Helfrich, is viewed as catcher number one from the college ranks in this draft. I think right now, based on what we know, Von Lackey is, and this is reflected in our rankings, the better prospect. And it's very marginal, but we know what Von Lackey brings to the table from a defensive standpoint. And the fact that he is so sure-handed and this really clean receiver, and he calls a good game, and like all of the boxes that you could want a catcher to check heading into their draft year, I think Von Lackey checks or gets close to checking most of them. Whereas Helfrich, it's more like, I think that the comparison that you made is really valuable between these two catchers and then the top of the pitching race, because it's like, to me, Ryder Helfrich is very much the Jackson Flora of the catching conversation, where I think the conversation and the things that we're hearing are the right things, and the momentum sounds like it's the right kind of momentum, but the question becomes, does it look like when the lights are on? And and I do wonder if he is going to be this really good receiver that we've heard about throughout the fall, and he's going to call his own game for a very talented Arkansas pitching staff this year. What does that look like? Like last year, he caught 61 games for a team that went to the national semifinal and was a drop fly ball to left field away from going to the national championship over LSU. But I think that you still need to see it. Like last year was not the cleanest year behind the plate for Helfrich, where it was much cleaner for Lackey. Where I do think that Helfrich has the edge, though, is I trust the bat a lot more. So if some ground is made up defensively and Helfrich kind of bridges that gap a little bit between him and Lackey on the defensive side, I would probably take Helfrich first, because I'm slightly more confident that he'll be the better hitter, whereas Lackey to me has some bat questions but fewer defensive questions.
Yeah, that'll make sense. So last year, the top catcher in the class, and maybe some people would put catcher in quotes because of the defensive questions, but Ike Irish went 19th overall, first catcher off the board. Would you take the over or under? So do you think the first catcher this year will go before 19th or after 19th? Our current board has them behind, but I feel like if I had to make a prediction, it wouldn't shock me if one or both of these guys moved up in front of that 19 spot by the end of the spring.
I'll take the under 19. I think they don't survive. So that's
before
19th. I was going to say, I think that's before the 19th pick. I just don't see the best college catcher in this draft lasting until the 20s. And especially because you brought up the most important point there, which is that Ike Irish went 19th and is not really a catcher. And these guys definitely are, both of them, I'd say.
One of the key factors for me in taking the under is we currently have five high school pitchers ranked in front of both of them. And if that remained the case on talent, the whole spring, that wouldn't shock me. But it's just so much easier for those players to go after that and get paid at that range than it is for the college catchers to do the same. So,
right. That, and I would say like there's a small group, but a present group of college corner outfielders who are above these catchers, and including some guys who have like hit tool questions. Like Sawyer Strohsnyder, I think, is going to be an outstanding college player this year, and I'm a huge fan of his. But I also know that the industry has questions about whether or not that hit tool is going to hold up against professional pitching. Is he a center fielder at the next level or a corner bat, I think, is kind of still a question. Yep. AJ Gracia, there's definitely a question about whether or not, I don't even know
two
if
guys,
questions at all.
Yeah, it's two guys you're mentioning right here, just notable slides down outside of the back of a top 10, more into our middle of the first round range.
Yeah, Gracia 17, Strohsnyder 18. So like they're inside the top 19 picks right now. Do I think that there's going to be a team or multiple teams that want to take a college catcher over that corner outfield hit to a question profiles? Yeah, I think that that's probably pretty reasonable. So like if you go through who we have ranked ahead of those two catchers right now, I think that you can easily get to like six or seven guys who I think that there's probably going to end up being some conversations about which profile you prefer and that it might help the catchers out a little bit.
Right. Okay. Those are kind of all the notable first round names who are moving in a direction I feel like is worth talking about. Let's break down a little bit further outside of this range. Three of the most notable up arrow names, just if you're looking at pure movement, are all college bats that just seem super well-rounded. The top of this group, Aiden Robbins, an outfielder out of Texas, or at Texas, the University of Texas. He moves from 87 to 35. We've got a lot of feedback that says he's just a slam dunk top 50 prospect, so we put him in that range. A little bit further down the board, we've got Logan Hughes, another outfielder out of Texas. He plays for Texas Tech. He goes from not on our top 100 to 53. And then maybe the guy that we've had the most internal chatter about in recent weeks and seems to be becoming a really popular name around the country for everyone interested in the draft. I got a lot of good draft questions about him in our chat, but that's Kansas first baseman Brady Ballinger, who moves from outside of our top 100 to 59. I feel like all three of these guys are pretty safe top two round profiles at this stage. And yeah, what stands out for all three is just really, really safe and proven offensive profiles.
Yep. That's it. And I'll start with Ballinger, because if you're a Rudner reader, you know that there has been no shortage of Ballinger content over the course of the last couple months. I'm a huge fan, like a huge, huge fan of Brady Ballinger. I will start by recognizing the flaws, which is that he is a first baseman. From everything that we've heard so far, he's a little bit of an undersized first baseman at that. But the offensive ability is not bested by a lot of players in this draft class. Like, he is a really good, pure hitter. Last year, the EV was basically 90 miles per hour on average. The barrel percentage, 32.9%. There are times where he can be a little bit passive, but it comes more to me as like very calculated. It was a 36.6% overall swing rate, which translated to, you know, a sub-70 heart swing and sub-60% zone swing rate. Those are low relative to college averages, especially for somebody who is a first baseman and does kind of have the power hitter profile slapped on him. But the contact rates are really good. He doesn't chase much out of the zone. I think he does a pretty good job overall of just getting the bat to the ball. And then the angles are outstanding. He's constantly hitting the ball in the air. His best contact is pulled, in the air. It was a 20.8% average launch angle, hard hit balls. It's a really good hitter. And like, if you break down the class with certain benchmarks in each of the important categories, I'm talking like overall contact percentage, angles, chase rates, and then average EVs, Brady Ballinger, there's like a very easy way to get him into a bucket that includes just guys like Rock Chalowski, him, and then like a couple other players. So the offensive skill is outstanding. Again, it's just now is the question of like, how high will a pure first baseman who has size questions go? He's a left-handed hitter, and I think that that'll limit the profile.
Well, one of the players that I think about as you're talking about his strengths as a hitter, and I think Andrew Fisher might have a little bit more pop and thump, but I feel like Andrew Fisher and Brady Ballinger check a lot of the same boxes. Both are very selective hitters. They're players who turn on the ball and put it in the air with great frequency. I think maybe the nitpicks I would have with Ballinger is just on average, he hasn't hit the ball quite as hard as Fisher. Maybe that'll change in his draft year this year. And he's also just a little bit more passive within the strike zone. I know that's one kind of question mark that scouts have. If you really want to drill into what's the flaw in the offensive profile, it might be that. Both are players who last spring swung at a rate under 40%. And I know
Ballinger made more contact overall. Like, to your point, he might not be swinging as much, but he actually did a better job of putting the bat on the ball overall. Right. So there's give and take there, but yeah.
Sure. So I do think that if he has a strong spring, and you're looking at like, okay, where can this profile go? Like, we just saw Andrew Fisher go right in the middle of the first round a year ago. Wouldn't shock me if Ballinger performs his way into that range either.
No, I agree with that. And then, you know, I'll transition us to the other two guys here.
Yep.
Two really exciting outfielders, Logan Hughes and Aiden Robbins. Robbins last year is the one that I kind of have circled on my preseason card here, just because it is a massive step up. All of his success last year came at Seton Hall, whereas Logan Hughes did it at Texas Tech. Now Aiden Robbins is going to be asked to keep that up in the SEC, where I guarantee you it is much harder to accomplish. Yep. But the numbers are like eye-popping. It was a 91.5 average EV last year. The swing rates, like, he's an aggressive hitter who is also super polished when it comes to the swing decisions and what he's offering at. He chased at a 21% rate and had a hard swing rate of 80%, 42.2% overall swing rate. The knock, if you're going to try and create one, is not necessarily the rate of contact, but what he's doing with his best contact. I would say that more air contact is probably desirable for the Aiden Robbins profile. I think that he does enough damage from a pure like exit velocity and strength standpoint that the power output could be better if he put the ball in the air with more consistency. But again, like, that's, if you're a pro team, to give, you know, people listening to this kind of look into how the cake is baked, pro teams are not that afraid of bad angles on guys. Like, if you have underlying strength and athleticism, I think angles are viewed as something that are really fixable. So Robbins, to me, is like, if he performs at even a fraction of what he was able to do at Seton Hall at Texas this year, we're talking about somebody who could push his way into the first round potentially.
And the difference too in this profile compared to Ballinger, as we talk about him, and probably the same for Logan Hughes as well when we move into that conversation. But Aiden Robbins is just a really good athlete. We've heard from scouts who think he can play all three outfield spots convincingly. I'll be curious to see what the specifics are on the defense evaluations are this spring. But he runs really well. He's a savvy base runner. In his career at Seton Hall, he went 30 for 33 on the bases. So he's just going to provide more defensive value, more base running value than a guy like Ballinger is going to. And yeah, I do think the transition in conferences will be something that's interesting to watch. But if he's able to sort of maintain the hitting traits that he's shown, another guy, we have him just outside of the first round, but it feels like a first round profile. There might be a lot of those profiles this year that just get squeezed out because the class is so good, but he certainly fits there.
Right. And I was going to say, you know, I think that the numbers of quality players is going to be something that's going to be hard for some of these players to overcome. But that being said, like, I have heard repeatedly from trusted sources on the evaluation side that Aiden Robbins is somebody who they already have in the first round on their respective boards. So the feedback coming into the year is, I mean, it's Helfrich territory in terms of just how loud it's been. And the kind of the groundswell of support that exists. So yeah, I mean, I could absolutely see Robbins in the first round, and I'll do it one more time here. I'll transition us again. I can see the same for Logan Hughes. And this is somebody who did it at the power conference level, and he's an absolute masher, 94 mile per hour average exit velocity. If you put just the players who we've had a conversation about in the last 5 minutes here, Logan Hughes, Aiden Robbins, Brady Ballinger, and Andrew Fisher from last year, the hardest hitter of the baseball on average. And I will add that all of these guys have a sample of over 100 batted balls.
Yep.
For Logan Hughes, it's over 150. He has the most batted balls in the entire sample. And his average EV last year was 94 miles per hour, which is the best of the group. You know, misreads be damned. I don't really care. Like, he is killing the baseball.
The same is true for 90th Max as well. Like, narrowly 90th topping Andrew Fisher, but like across the board in all of our like three exit velocity checkpoints, like, he is the best of the bunch.
Yep, 62% hard hit rate from last year, which is searing the ball constantly. He is the most aggressive swinger of the bunch at basically 45% overall swing rate. And that number, what's weird is, like, he's a super aggressive hitter overall, but when it comes to heart swing, he's the second worst of that group of four hitters who we just named at 75%. Zone swing, 68.8%, is also the second lowest, just above Ballinger, who's not even in the 60s. He does chase a little bit, so like the aggression isn't as calculated, but like a 24% chase rate on somebody who's swinging the bat 45% of the time doesn't scare me. But like Aiden Robbins, the conversation will again be, what is the batted ball profile? Because it is not in the air as much as you would want for somebody who is, like I said, a killer of the baseball.
The player that this reminds me of from last year's class is almost like a Brandon Compton, but maybe with a little bit less top end power and a little bit more contact. And I think that contact area is key. Because Brandon Compton consistently had the strikeout questions. He struck out 23% of the time in his career at Arizona State. Logan Hughes has never struck out anywhere near that clip. I mean, he did start his career at Stetson. He performed well there, struck out 13.9% of the time in 2024. But then with Texas Tech, Logan Hughes is hitting 19 home runs, 13 doubles, OPS over 1,100, with a sub 10% strikeout rate. So even though most people seem to think he's definitely a corner outfielder moving forward, there's maybe less speed and athleticism to dream on from the defensive standpoint. It is a really exciting contact power combination. And maybe among these players we're talking about today, because he's already done it in a power conference, you maybe have the most conviction in his offensive traits. So I think all three of these guys are exciting. And if all three of these guys wound up in the first round, I wouldn't be shocked.
You, that was perfectly timed, your exit out of that statement, because I just ran a very, very crude, brief, last second data query here. One thing that I love to do, one thing I'm obsessed with is give me like certain benchmarks in certain categories and see how many guys fall into the bucket. Right. Last year in college baseball, these are the three categories that I filtered this down to in the time that you were saying your piece there. Average exit velocity, 94 plus, hard hit rate, 60 plus percent, zone contact rate, 88% or higher. There are two players who had a sample of more than three batted balls last year who fit into that category.
Can I guess?
Yeah, you can.
Is one was someone who was drafted last year, I'm assuming?
Correct.
Okay. What? Give me the thresholds one more time.
It is a 94 mile per hour exit velocity or harder, average EV, a 60% or better hard hit rate, and an 88% overall contact rate or better, zone contact rate or better.
Oh, man. And this was last spring.
Yeah.
Should
I tell you where he was drafted?
Sure.
He was a third round pick out of a power conference. And I will also add that he is, like our friend Logan Hughes, a hard-hitting, right-handed-hitting corner outfielder.
Hard-hitting, right-handed corner outfielder. Let's see. Logan, I won't take up too much. Is it Ethan Frey?
It is Ethan Frey. That was okay. Well done. Look at you.
Yeah.
Yes, the two college baseball players last year who produced, I will just reiterate the criteria, a 94 mile per hour average exit velocity or better, a 60% hard hit rate or higher, and an 88% zone contact rate or better were nice. Ethan Frey at LSU and Logan Hughes at Texas Tech.
Beautiful. I love that. What a great query that was run in real time there. So nice, Jacob. Okay, well, I hate to end the podcast on a down note, but maybe we're talking about some of the players that that are moving down and maybe some of the questions and rationale for that. But there is a decent chunk of college names. Again, a lot of the talk today has been focused on college. It just happens that's the case for the bigger movers. But I just feel like there are a lot of these questionable profiles that maybe just have had more questions over the past few weeks and months of us collecting feedback. We continue to slide Caden Bogenpohl down. And I think, at least from our perspective, that has as much to do with us being a little bit too aggressive with where we started him out as anything. Yes. And there are just significantly more hit tool concerns than I think we were probably expecting for him to have at the start, in addition to competition questions, the ankle questions he has. Daniel Cuvée is another player who's moving down, corner infielder out of Miami. I think for him, it's mostly just a lot of people think he's likely to move to first base. And while the production with Miami has been pretty phenomenal, there are a lot of underlying like pure hit questions, approach questions, swing and miss questions. And then there's this duo of Steven Milam and Jaron Advincula, are in this middle infielder bucket of like really solid college players. And we're just getting a lot of impact power questions. So we're moving all these guys down slightly, and maybe just worth pointing those names out, because I do think they're the most notable names trending down.
Yeah, where do you want to start?
We've talked about Bogenpohl a lot, so I'm curious where you're at with Milam and Advincula. I would say this is a profile in general that I'm a little bit more skeptical of, and so I thought made sense to move them down based on just my personal preferences and also the feedback. But I feel like it's just very hard to profile as a top 50 player, which I think we've had both these guys in that top 50 range at various points, when the impact is that much of a question, particularly in the case of Milam, where I'm not quite as convinced he's definitely a shortstop, although he'll get a chance to prove it this year. So I think for both these players, maybe Advincula has less questions about whether he can play shortstop at the next level, but if they can just show more power, that would be really huge for their profiles.
Yeah, I think that the key, we'll start with Advincula. the bat is like exceptionally light, and that is a concern. Last year we saw him just, I don't need to go over the raw numbers themselves, but like these are the categories where he was well below average. Average EV, 90th percentile EV, and max EV were all either reasonable, like roughly average, or clearly below. Clearly below being the average exit velocity. This is the one that scares me the most. The chase rate was over 30% last year, which is well below average. And then like for somebody who's an undersized middle infielder, like defensive first table setting type, that is an astronomically high number. He's a nearly 50% swinger who's chasing over 30%. He does make a lot of contact. So I think you kind of save yourself there a little bit. It's a 91% zone contact rate, 87% overall contact rate. Both of those numbers are well above average. The air pull and all of the launch angle categories are also below average. And so you're talking about a player who needs to do a ton in terms of like, he's got to be an outstanding contact hitter this year in the ACC to change people's minds while also showing that he has the chops to play a premium position. Otherwise, it's a really hard profile to get behind. And I think that you can say the same thing about Steven Milam. He is a seriously undersized 5'7", 5'8"-ish switch hitting shortstop. I do think that he could probably play the position, but an undersized, lighter hitting shortstop, even if he makes a lot of contact, is not going to get a lot of favor on draft day. And he does do a better job of putting the ball in the air, but like almost at a rate that you wish he wouldn't, considering how hard he hits the ball, it not being like in the power hitter category. Like you would want to see him almost be a little bit more of a line drive hitter and like punishing gaps and then using his athleticism, and he doesn't do that. And so those were the concerns that came up for us, both in terms of the conversations we were having and then what we were hearing in the industry.
The way I would frame like how we compare and contrast, or at least how I'm viewing them, is Advíncula, you have a little bit more confidence in the shortstop defense. In Milam, there's a little bit more selectivity and a little bit more thump, but also significantly less confidence in the shortstop defense profile. So I think Milam might be the guy that I think has a chance to move up to a greater degree this spring, just because I think if he goes out and he looks like an average shortstop and people are like, yeah, he can stick there, then some of the flaws in this profile that we're pointing out will be a little bit, you'll be more forgiving towards them. And there just seems to be a greater threshold of impact that he has compared to Advíncula. Both are guys that are close to maxed out. I wouldn't expect them to have huge physical gains in the future, but it is maybe interesting to think about the 5'8", 185-pound guys is having a little bit more thump. So, I mean, Milam does have a double-digit home run season under his belt. He had 8 home runs as a freshman, 11 as a sophomore in 2025. Advíncula has hit 11 total in his 2 years at Cal. So I guess we'll just see with those guys moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's just a tough profile to have, the undersized middle infielder. Like, you have to be so good as a defender. I'll give for people who are interested in like the pro prospect side of this conversation, I'll liken this, and you can slow me down if you want, but I'll liken this almost a little bit to like Starlin Cabba and the conversations that we had about him in the Marlins system and where he should rank. Undersized shortstop with a light bat who is an outstanding, like top of the scale 80 defender at shortstop. He will 100% play the position almost regardless of who offensively is on a team with him, regardless of level. Like, that's the guy you're going to put at shortstop because he's so good at the position. But the bat is so light that like there are conversations that need to be had about how much value you can put on him from a prospect standpoint and a ranking standpoint, because that's what happens with these guys. And like, I don't know that either player who we're talking about right now, in addition to having bat questions, makes up enough ground defensively to like outdo somebody who is in their category already as a pro, like Acaba, who is undersized, light at the plate, but so tremendous at shortstop that you're going to forgive a lot of sins offensively because it's somebody who's going to create value somewhere else. I don't yet see that. Not saying we won't, but going into the season, at least, I don't know that you could say that about Advíncula or Milam.
No. Yeah, I don't think you can for either of them. I mean, Advíncula is a guy who spent basically the entirety of his college career at second base now and is only going to slide over to the position. So I could even be high now talking about how I view him defensively. Both of them still have to go prove it and do it. So Unless you want to hit on one of these other down arrow guys, Jacob, I think we can kind of wrap things here. But I will give you a final comment if you have something else you want to add on anyone or the top 200 list as a whole.
Let's talk about two players real quick. I want to talk about Caden Bogenpohl because I do think that there's like an interesting range of comparison that exists to players who were drafted last year. Those being Nolan Schubart at Oklahoma State, who went in the third round, and Jace Lavallette, who obviously was the top prospect going into the year and then ends up going, 17th overall in the draft.
In the 20s to the Guardians.
In the 20s, okay. So yep. Those three profiles are remarkably similar in just about every category. Average EVs are almost exactly the same across the board. They swing, that's probably the biggest difference between them. Nolan Schubart is the most aggressive swinger of the bunch, but Jace and Caden Bogenpohl, both in that 35-36% range. Jace a little bit more selective on pitches inside the zone. The contact rates are nearly identical for all three of them. The chase rates are basically identical for Bogenpohl and Lavallette. Nolan Schubart chases a little bit more. And then the biggest separator between those three guys is how they put their best contact onto the field. Last year in air pull percentage, Nolan Schubart, 55.1%. It's the reason that there are so many people who still love him, even though he swings and misses a lot, even though there's questions about how much he's going to hit. When he puts the ball in the air, he's doing damage because he's going to kill it and it's going to go super far. Jace Lavallette, pretty much the exact same thing. Angles are really good, capable of being super strong. The majority of Caden Bogenpohl's contact is on the ground. His best contact on a line, last year his air pull percentage was 26.5%. That is 21% lower than Jace Lavallette, who came in almost 10% lower than Nolan Schubart. So my point is, they are built the same way. I think that they swing the same way. I think that the vision for a left-handed hitting, probably long-term corner outfield prospect is very similar between all three of those guys. But the critical difference and the reason he fell was because Bogenpohl's contact quality, as hard as it is not very good. He is a ground ball hitter, and he's way too selective. So that was the problem with Bogenpohl, and I wanted to bring that up. And then the other guy is Cole Carlone. We moved him down ahead of the year. He arguably has some of the best stuff among the college left-handed pitching demographic in this class. Was down arrow because we don't know what the role is going to be long-term. It sounds like there is still questions about will he be a starter or a reliever? I can actually say in real time, updating on this podcast, he will start opening night for Arizona State. But again, that is, I think, more a matter of circumstance and like who else is there around him. Mm-hmm. And it puts Arizona State in a position where it's like, you need this guy to start if you're Arizona State for you to be as good as you can possibly be. So you go and you give him the opportunity, almost like a Gabe Gackle last year, got the opportunity to start and then didn't necessarily go the way they wanted it to. So they put him back in the bullpen. I think this could be similar to that. We just didn't know. We don't think that there's enough confidence in him as a starting pitcher to rank him prominently yet, but I could see him moving up or down based on how that goes.
Yeah, those reliever questions are significant with him. He's a guy who's made two starts in his college career in 55 total appearances with Arizona State, and just the erratic nature of his strike throwing. He did make some strides in that department. It was a 13.7% walk rate in 24, lower to 11.3% in 2025, but that's still a rate higher than you'd like to see for someone who profiles as a starter at the next level. So if he can answer that question, I think his stuff fits top 50 pretty safely. It's a really electric arm, but that's the area he needs to address. So glad you hit on both those players here down the stretch. Jacob, good insight there. We're close now. Again, one more podcast before we have actual games going on. Then we'll be breaking down what we're actually seeing, what's happening. It'll be fun to do. I feel like we've spent so long talking about expectations and previewing and who we're excited about and sleepers, and it'll be really fun to talk about. I just saw X last weekend, so I'm looking forward to that. Check out the site. Plenty of good content there. Conference previews are being rolled out. We got a lot more draft content just to get you ready for the season. I'll have a piece on our annual kind of first-round to-do list piece ahead of the season getting rolling. I'm also really excited for our annual player draft that myself, Jacob, and Ben will probably do before the season gets rolling as well. So thank you guys for listening. Thanks for supporting Baseball America, subscribing, allowing us to do all this content and travel across the country to tell you guys about these players. We really do appreciate it. For Jacob, I'm Carlos. We'll see you next time.